called the bill that I sent that they don't want to.
Revenue is open. Good morning. We have a presentation on the federal tax reform plans that are out there. First, I would like to vote on Senate Bill 162 to the floor, so I'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 162. Chris is here. I believe we have an amendment.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This was a bill that touches on two things. The first section deals with corporation tax credits that may or may not be extended to S corporations, and the second section deals with the working family dependent care credit. There is an amendment that makes technical changes, and so I can just walk through those,
please.
So walking through the amendment, so conceptually, the changes in the amendment. The first section, the drafted bill removes some rulemaking authority for the Department of Revenue, just to refresh the committee's memory. This is a part of statute that identifies tax credits, corporation tax credits that can be extended to S corporations. It included language that allowed the Department of Revenue rulemaking authority to extend other credits. The drafted bill removes the rulemaking authority, so then the question was, well, what about the credits for the S corporations that had been established in rule? The amendment simply adds all of the S corporation tax credits that were established in rule, adds them to statute. So what you get in effect is a no change situation for which corporations can claim which tax credits. So that's section one. The other changes are in section two and pertain to the working family dependent care credit. And it makes four changes there. It extends the credit to non-married taxpayers who are seeking employment or attending school. That was part of the intent in the legislation in 2015. So it just clarifies that. It also limits the qualifying expenses to income earned in Oregon. And then it prohibits interest from being paid on the refundable portion of the tax credit. The way current law reads, if a taxpayer is allowed a refundable portion, they're due a check back from the state, and the timing is such that it would have incurred some interest. This prohibits that interest from being paid, given that it's not a, that the refundable portion is not a refund of tax. It's a different kind of payment. And then the other change is that the amendment deletes restrictions related to a capital loss or net operating loss. So it just removes that from the bill. That's more of a policy question. Because the way the bill was drafted, if a taxpayer had a what was intended to be a net capital loss or a net operating loss, they wouldn't be allowed to claim the tax credit. So the amendment just removes that because a policy option, that is certainly a viable option for the committee to consider. Another way to deal with that is to remove those negative income amounts, the net operating loss or the net capital loss, from the AGI, and then allow the taxpayer to claim that tax credit. So rather than disallowing the tax credit, it's just based off a modified AGI as opposed to the reported AGI. So, but that policy question is removed from the bill. So all of the changes in here are considered technical. It has a minimal fiscal impact and a minimal revenue impact.
This is highly technical.
It's very technical, yes.
Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment into SB 162, and then I'll speak to the amendment.
Senator Boquist moves dash ones to Senate Bill 162. Discussion, Senator Boquist.
Just for clarification, add on to what Chris pointed out, as originally written, there were some technical errors to the technical changes for the technical fixes. And the effects of the amendments, number one through five, that are on the staff measure summary, actually technically fix the technical changes to the technical amendment. And so, as amended, it makes it a better bill.
Further discussion?
Not after that. I can't talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, but after yesterday, I just want to point out I might screw up here.
Okay, the amendment is added.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 162 as amended by the dash one to the floor with a do pass.
Senator Boquist moves SB 162 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. SB 162 as amended goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. I will carry it. And we'll close the work session. Paul, did you want to come up here for our federal tax presentation? Thanks. Is this you? Or is this me?
That's what Paul and Christine.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. We've gotten a lot of questions from the committee and from others about some of the implications for federal tax reform proposals. So we thought it would be worth spending a meeting kind of talking through those, what we know and what we don't know and what we've seen from past experience. Most of what we will be saying today is based on this federal tax reform report that's an OLIS from the Tax Foundation, which is kind of a general description, but it gives you a good structure framework to think about some of those implications. Before I get started on talking about that, just to emphasize that what we know now is pretty general. There hasn't been any specific language drafted. We have a proposal that was developed prior to the election by the House Republicans, and that's pretty detailed, and so I'm going to focus on that. And then we have some other proposals that are similar in a lot of regards by the administration, again, that were done during the presidential campaign, but also have some significant differences. So we'll talk about what those are. And the main thing, our main goal here is to have you start thinking about and recognizing that not only is it the kind of general policy, but the specifics of how the feds actually do it has a significantly different effect on Oregon depending on how they do it. So to emphasize that, and so you'll be able to think through that, because one of the things that may very well occur is you will get a major federal tax reform change sometime during the interim, and changes to the tax base we will automatically connect to through the rolling reconnect, and we'll have start to have an immediate effect on our revenue stream if, depending on what those changes are. So I've got a handout that worked through. I'm going to talk through kind of generally what we expect from these various provisions, and then Christine has gone over and gone through the detail for both the House Republican proposal and some of the changes that the president has talked about, and she's got some rough numbers on those to give you a sense of what those magnitudes are. So first of all, what I focused on in this table is the House Republican proposal, because it is more detailed than what the president has presented. The first thing is that a major element actually in both the proposals is a significant reduction in overall personal income tax rates. And you can see that that in general we've got seven rates right now, a top rate of 38%. This would lower it down to 33% and consolidate into three brackets. So it's a consolidation of brackets and a reduction in the top rate. For Oregon, a rate change does not have a direct effect on our revenue. We have our own rate structure, and that doesn't change with federal changes. But what does change is the federal tax subtraction. So that's what I've got on my table when I say indirect. That's what I'm talking about. A change in federal taxes will impact the federal tax subtraction. So a reduction in federal taxes means a smaller subtraction on your Oregon taxable income and an increase in revenue for the state. So that's why I've got that listed as an indirect effect through the subtraction, and positive because it'll increase Oregon revenue. Now, of course, that subtraction is limited. We have a cap of $6,500, and that's, of course, goes way back to the historically we've changed that a lot, and had a couple of ballot measure on that, measure 88. But now it's at $6,500, and it is indexed to inflation. The other major change that you made to the subtraction was in measure 66, where now, based on adjusted gross income, it is phased out. So for a joint filer above $250,000, it's phased out in 20% increments, so that by the time you get to $290,000 in adjusted gross income, not taxable, AGI, it's gone. You have no subtraction. So those folks at the high end that get a reduction in federal taxes, it won't affect their subtraction because they're already at the cap or it's phased out. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. But the changes at the lower end tend to filter through the subtraction and impact our revenue stream. So we would anticipate a positive impact there. Another element in the House Republican proposal is an increase in the standard deduction. So the deduction will double for joint filers, also double for single filers, from 12 to 24,000. Again, this is an indirect effect. Since it's a standard deduction, you're going to see a high proportion of affected taxpayers will be probably below the cap, and certainly below the income phase out. So that's going to definitely be an impact on the federal subtraction and a positive impact on Oregon revenue. Another element to the proposal is to change the personal exemption. And essentially what the plan does is it eliminates the exemption for individuals and spouses. And that's part of the trade-off with the standard. You get a bigger standard deduction, but the exemption is eliminated. And it's replaced for dependents with a $500 credit. So the net effect of that, I've got, is uncertain. It would be indirect. We don't connect to rates, and we don't connect to credits. So credits are all outside. So those are all just indirect. The net effect of the two, of eliminating the exemption for the taxpayer and the spouse, would offset some of the impact from the credit per child. So I have that as an uncertain. Another element of the plan is that it eliminates the alternative minimum. And the alternative minimum is not something we directly connect to, but it can have some indirects, although we think the impacts will be relatively small. The next two items are the big ones in terms of their impact on Oregon's revenue. The first one is on investment income. If some of you may remember back prior to the last major change in the federal tax base in the late 80s, 1986, capital gains was taxed at the ordinary rate, but you were allowed to exclude 50% of it. So in effect, you paid half the rate. So if it was a nominal rate of 30%, you got to exclude 50% of it, you really paid 15%. But in the 1986 provisions, changes, what the federal government did was eliminated the exclusion, made all capital gains income taxable, but gave it a lower rate. So it was taxed, it's varied, but now it's 20%. So the net effect of that change in the late 80s for Oregon was a significant increase in revenue. Because now, instead of having an exclusion on a portion of capital gains, you now had capital gains as part of the tax base. And again, if the feds change their rates, that doesn't affect us. So that was a big base broadening thing. So what this proposal would do is move us back to where we were prior to 86. So now they haven't called it an exclusion, they've called it a deduction off what you would do is take not only your capital gains income, but also your interest and dividend income, and deduct 50% of that from taxable income. And that's, we think Oregon would automatically connect to that if that provision is written that way. Those three income sources, capital gains, interest, and dividend income, are about 8% of the base, the total base. So you would be, in effect, deducting 4% of the base. So it would be a significant effect on Oregon revenue, significant direct negative effect on our taxable income.
Can you ballpark a figure?
No.
Christine's ballparked it.
Yep. I'll go through that later, but Mr. Chair, it's in 17-19, assuming that this is implemented for tax year 2017, which is a bit up in the air, it would be $880.1 million less revenue.
Negative from that one 50% deduction.
Right. Okay. But if you look at the next items there, which is the itemized deductions I mentioned, these are pretty close to offsetting that. One thing I do have that might be helpful too in OLIS is I've got the tax expenditure list and the estimates for all the federal deductions, so that might be useful to look at too. But on the itemized deductions, this, of course, is something that we connect to through the rolling reconnect. And right now, we connect to all the Schedule A. The only thing that doesn't affect us would be state income taxes. We don't allow you to deduct state income taxes from state income taxes. So, but all the non-income taxes we're connected to. But what the federal proposal would do is eliminate the deductions for state and local taxes. So that's been a big discussion for at least a couple of decades. Many have argued that really that's what the federal government has done through the alternative minimum, because if you think about the mechanics of the alternative minimum, that's the main thing that's disallowed in calculating the add back that you have through the alternative minimum. So the deduction for state and local taxes would be a major one. For our revenue, it would be the property tax. And if you look at the tax expenditure report, property taxes reduced our revenue by, I've got in the back of the sheet, by about $470 million. So it's a huge impact. If that deduction goes away, you get a plus $400 million. And Christine has some specifics on that one, too. The other one is through the medical expenses. And one of the things that was changed in over the last few years around the medical expenses was to increase the threshold. It used to be over 7% of AGI. You got to count medical expenses. Now it's 10%. And seniors, I think, get to 10% this year, I think. So now what this proposal would do is eliminate that deduction. And that's about, if you look at the tax expenditure report, about $230 million for 17-19 biennium. So another large number, another large revenue gain for the state. So those two items would be the biggest gains and the biggest to the state. That's the biggest base broadening provisions. There's also a series of what are called miscellaneous deductions around things like theft losses and job expenses and those kinds of things. So those all would go away, and the only thing that would be left for Schedule A are two big ones, but the biggest is mortgage interest, which is about half of Schedule A deductions, and the other would be charitable contributions. So those would continue into the plan. So that's the direct positive, direct negative. So roughly those two proposals would cancel out. But again, it depends very much on how the federal law is structured. Let's say, for example, that Congress decides, well, instead of doing this deduction on investment income, let's just give them a lower rate. And if they decide to go that route, from their standpoint, that would be a similar policy, it has a similar effect. But for us, it would be a huge difference because there wouldn't be this impact on our tax base. So that's why I say that the way that plan is actually structured, the way the law is written, will have, you know, that'll be a crucial factor in what its ultimate effect will be on our immediate effect on us. So now an even bigger change is around business taxes, and these are pretty we don't have a good sense of what all the implications would be. We can look at some of the components and speculate on what they are, but this will give you some familiarity with some of the discussions you've had around major changes to Oregon's business taxes. The House Republican proposal would convert our current income tax, which now is based on worldwide reporting, where you only report a portion of it at the water's edge, and you don't that is outside the U.S. is not taxable until it's repatriated into the country. under this proposal, the corporate tax base would become destination-based, meaning it would be based on where the market is, where the sale takes place. So you wouldn't have this worldwide reporting anymore. Your tax base would be the amount of sales you have in the state. Very similar to some of the proposals you've talked about around a gross receipts tax and destination-based. So that would be a major change. It would also have eliminate some of the deductions that we have had a big impact on Oregon's tax base in the past. One of them would be through capital purchases and capital spending and how that's affected. This has been the biggest swing factor. As you recall, what's typically happened during recessions, the Feds have tended to accelerate depreciation. And what that does is, over the long term, that doesn't affect revenue much because, it's a timing thing. But if they accelerate depreciation, then they pull forward those deductions, and that's had, as you recall, some significant impacts on Oregon's revenue during recessions. So what an expensing provision would do would have it would one time pull all those expenses forward, be a revenue loss in the short term, but in the long term it would be revenue neutral. Because what you deduct today, you wouldn't be able to deduct again tomorrow. So another provision that would actually have a positive impact on revenue would be elimination of the net interest expense. So that's one of the big deductions you have on the current net income tax for corporate income. So that would go away with this cash flow accounting approach. And finally, the issue around worldwide income and reporting income and tax havens and that kind of thing and trying to encourage repatriation of income back to the U.S. so it could be taxed, all that would go away under this approach. There would be no residual tax on worldwide income. It would just be based on your market where your destination of your sales are. So that's a direct effect because that would impact our base. The net effect we think is uncertain. We do think in general though that this kind of an approach would be a net positive for Oregon's economy over time. We're an export-oriented state. It would probably be a net positive for us in an indirect sense over time. The rate would be a much lower on this base. Instead of 35% we have now, it would go to 20%. That would be an indirect effect and uncertain depending on what happens to our base. The other element is that there's a rate cap on pass-through income. The overall cap is 33%. This proposal would put a cap of 25% on pass-through income. This would reduce some of those federal taxes. We suspect that impact would be minimal, some through the subtraction, but largely these probably would be folks that would be outside the cap. So, is
it disappearing? That one crashed.
Okay. So the other piece that's here is on the estate tax. The proposal would eliminate the estate tax. So we are not directly connected to the estate tax. You created an independent statute of the federal estate tax. When the Feds started making fundamental changes in the early 2000s, we weren't sure of that, but as we consulted with counsel, it became clear that this is not part of any rolling reconnect. The estate tax is a separate tax. Any changes you have to actually make to it through statutory changes. We also have a lot different threshold. Of course, we have $1 million threshold. The Feds have a $5 million threshold. So we're already operating pretty independently, but as the Tax Foundation points out, there may be some administrative issues there where we would no longer have that federal base or federal returns to compare with for the higher estates. So those gives you a sense of kind of our overall analysis of things. If you look back historically, the last time the federal government really did undertake a fundamental change in the tax base was in 1986. And of course, Bob Packwood was chair of Senate Finance. And there was a significant base broadening. I mentioned the capital gains. There was a disallowance of the sales tax deduction at that time. IRA deductions were a lot more generous prior to that time. So That base broadened the base. What the legislature did in 1987 was, prior to that, we had a top rate of 10%. We'd gone to 10.8% during the recession in the early 80s. That was, it had returned back to 10% in 1984. And then with the federal base broadening, the legislature established a new three-rate schedule, 5, 7, and 9. And that was what stayed in place until 2009 when you added the additional 9.9 bracket. The standard deduction was also increased at that time. And, of course, as we've told you many times, it's always hard to parse out what, you know, individual elements of policy and what impacts they had. But during that period, and this was a period of economic expansion, but during that period from the comparing 86-87 with 88-89, income tax collections grew 20% over that two-year period. So the reason why I use two-year periods, you should be able to remember, there were two large kickers in those two, in those odd numbered years. So the growth between that two-year period was 20%. So the bottom line is, I mean, the effect is highly uncertain, and it really depends on the specifics and how they come through, and the timing of that too could complicate fiscal planning significantly. But, you know, anytime we look at federal tax reform, we know that from Oregon's standpoint, we're going to be one of the states that is most impacted in all likelihood because of our reliance on the personal income tax, because of our conformity to the federal tax base, and also our one-of-a-kind revenue limit, known affectionately as the kicker, could have a significant effect on, depending on when that when those changes occur and what their net effect on revenue is. So we'll be watching that closely, and I don't think we may see something during the session, but that's hard to say.
Paul, thank you. That's excellent. Can you expand a little bit on the ramifications of the kicker in the timing and why that's significant?
The kicker is the constitutional language is that the governor shall have prepared, as soon as practical, following sine die of a odd number session year session, an estimate of the close of session revenue. And that close of session estimate is the latest forecast available to the legislature plus the net effect of legislative changes. So, and that's set at that time. So that typically occurs in August. You get that number, August of 17. So that number does not change, cannot change, unless you, with a two-thirds vote in each chamber, change the estimate. So the Constitution allows you to do that on a one-time per biennium basis. So the only time you've done that was with the corporate kicker in 2007, when you changed that to, you increased the estimate, which in effect took away the kicker. That, you know, there's a lot of confusion about it with annual sessions and so forth. None of that matters. It's that close of session estimate following the end of the long session. So if we have, for example, a major federal base broadening, let's say that they go through and do the plan, the House Republican plan, in terms of eliminating the most of the itemized deductions, and we get a big windfall. Well, there would be no change in the kicker base, so that could certainly have likely trigger a kicker. Now, you could take actions in that case. You could disconnect from those changes, so you could come in actively and disconnect. You could delay connection to those changes, for example. So those anything that you would do that would affect the revenue stream could affect the kicker calculation.
Senator Bogus?
A couple of things, mostly for the record. In looking at the 2017 budget resolution, the federal government, in that budget resolution, the three potential budget reconciliations that can be done, which are revenue, budget, and raising the debt ceiling. There's only three of them. According to the 2017 budget resolution, they must be completed by June 15th of this year. The reality is we can speculate, which is perfectly fine, but I mean, I
think the political savvy of the five members here pretty well know that anything that happens in the federal Congress is not, in this relationship, it's not going to be 60 votes. So therefore, after June 15th, the 51 vote option to make any changes in the federal Congress is eliminated until the middle of next year again. So if there aren't changes by the federal Congress by June 15th, they're not going to happen for at least another year. That's one point for us just to keep in mind. I did, as Paul pointed out, that the last time one of these major events happened, we saw a 20% increase. And everybody is speculating, and economists are sort of like lawyers, no disrespect to our own, but I think LRO has looked at the Tax Foundation, has done an estimate of the what they call the blue dog Republican proposal, because there were Democrats involved in this too, about a year ago, and they estimated their sort of numbers are around a $2 billion increase to revenue if that was the proposal adopted. And then, of course, the right-wing conservative Pew Research Group economists looked at this, and theirs was a little bit more optimistic. They actually saw a 40% revenue gain, but offset by a 30% inflation gain or loss, and a 16% gain for the state of Oregon. So I think the key point is that Dr. Warner raised up, it's sort of like going to, Grand Round or Lincoln City and playing the slot machines up until the point where they open the new casino in the state of Washington. It's that wide open of what transpires. But for this year, I mean, the only changes that I think are possible will have to happen before June 15th, just pragmatically speaking.
So, Mr. Vice Chair, what that means is it would probably, for any change you see, it would likely occur in the interim. And if we go past this year, it probably would be beyond the next year's annual session.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Just because of knowing the parameters we have to deal with, we get the May revenue forecast approximately May 15th. I mean, if there was a change by June 15th, I do believe it's within the legislative powers of us to go back to the state economists and ask them to revise the revenue forecast. Is that not correct, Dr. Warner? There are mechanisms.
I would have to confer with counsel, but the way the statute reads, the legislature is to use the latest available forecast. And the quarterly forecasts are something that are done on there to be updated quarterly. So that's something we need to look closely at.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the three magic words are notwithstanding. So it is within the legislature's power. It's certainly within the governor's desire, I would say, that we could, in fact, take statutory action very quickly to require a new revenue forecast. Or we could just accept the one we have and realize we're going to have, I don't know, a $2 or $3 billion kicker.
I would recommend committee very much reading this federal tax reform tax foundation report and read it twice, because that's how, at least for me, that's how long it takes to digest. And then reading Paul's memo, and that's the beginning of getting your head around this thing. And I would note in the tax foundation report, there's a, you know, possible option for states, and there's a long section on special sessions, because all states are looking at this, and it's probably going to happen, they speculate, after states put their 2018 budgets to bed,
right.
And so you're going to have to come in and look at this. That's on page 14. But
And again, Mr. Chair, that's one of the things they say complicates are those states that have biennial budgets,
yeah,
because you have, you're looking at a two-year budget.
Senator Richard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, would it be prudent when we do our May forecast as a supplement, say, however, if this, and this happens, the forecast could look like this. Is it prudent to do that at that time?
Senator Batchelor, Mr. Chair, yeah, you know, there The forecast has done alternatives. We've looked at alternative scenarios in the past. Certainly, you know, after the experience of the recessions, what if we were to go into recession? And so we've looked at those kind of confidence intervals. So that would obviously be one of the things that would be looked at. And if we had some pretty good idea, what a better idea than we do now as to what would be included in a plan, then we could get a lot closer estimate of what it's likely to be, or what that alternative would be. Now, when the forecast process, we have very strict guidelines around state laws, and cannot assume, we don't assume anything that you do until you do it. So it's all current law strictly, and that's the way our practice has been. But the federal changes are a lot more loose, because we're always building in some kind of presumed general assumption about what federal fiscal policy is going to be in terms of taxes and spending, because it affects the macroeconomy. So that's something that we could look at and make a judgment call on what is the likelihood, what's the most likely path in terms of federal policy, even if it's not actually enacted. So, Mr. Chair, Christine has worked through some specifics on both. I just focused on the House Republican plan, but the Tax Foundation report also has the President's proposals that were made during the campaign. I think it released in the summer. And so she's got some specifics on that in a table.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, in OLIS, the file is called Tax Reform Proposals, and so this is just going to be a little bit of a recap of some of the stuff that Paul's gone through here, but maybe with the focus on the revenue, potential revenue impacts of these different proposals. So the first set of four items on this list are going to have an indirect impact on the Oregon revenue, and that would be through the federal tax subtraction. and in terms of this impact, the really bulk of it is going to happen for people with income below the phase outs of $125,000 single and $250,000 joint in income. And so really overall, the House Republican plan is a 6% decline in federal revenue, and so that would be an estimated revenue impact of $55.4 million, basically due to reducing the federal tax subtraction. of course, that's probably an upper end estimate, because if you take the impacts of the higher income people out of that equation, it would be somewhat lower. Also, the President's plan is a 14% decline in revenue estimated, so loosely that would be $129 million to Oregon, to the positive. And again, that would be an upper end because of the effect of the higher income folks. So, you know, the federal changes, It's kind of, I haven't seen a distribution of how it impacts different income levels, but it seems that the rate reduction is a little bit higher at the higher income. The 33%, 35%, and 39.6% brackets are all to a 33% bracket. But at the same time, the standard deduction is increased somewhat, so that would influence the lower income groups a little bit more. So it's kind of hard to tell where that's going to pan out, but overall the impacts are in the right column there. As Paul mentioned, the investment income would basically cause a deduction for 50% of the investment income, and that would be capital gains, dividends, and interest income. And that's the bulk of the negative impact. That's in the House Republicans' plan. The President's plan would just keep the current structure, and so that impact is zero. But the House Republican plan would be a negative $880 million in 2017-18, assuming it's phased in at that time. The next impact, almost offsetting to the positive, are the itemized deductions. And so the plan would be to eliminate all the itemized deductions, except for home mortgage interest and charitable contributions that Paul mentioned that. And so the increase there is $792.8 million. And so that was calculated through the tax calculator model, which models the impact of people reverting to the standard deduction in cases where their itemized deductions become too low. So it's a little bit more of a realistic estimate than what you would get just by adding the various tax expenditures for those itemized deductions. but it almost offsets the investment income, but not quite. The final row there is the child tax benefits. And so the House Republicans plan would be a $500 non-refundable credit per child. And so that really wouldn't affect Oregon's income. But the president's plan would be to exclude child care from the adjusted gross income. And that actually could have a pretty profound effect on Oregon income. It's estimated to be around $600 million in decline. And I just did a population estimate of how many minors there are in the state, and then how many people stay at home with their children, and so what's the demand for child care. But it came out to around $600 million to the negative. If you find a total for the House Republican plan, the net negative is $32.6 million, just as a preliminary estimate. And President Trump's plan is a little bit more extreme because of the, particularly the child tax benefits that I just talked about, and that would be negative $460 million in net impact when all of the different puts and takes are added up. So, just in summary.
Paul, I heard you say earlier today that, you know, depending on how this goes, it feels like a wash.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, certainly the House Republican plan is pretty close to a wash in Christine's numbers. But as I say, you have some big positives and big negatives. So, I mean, that means you have some swings either way, depending on the specifics. And I do think with the investment income, it is very possible that it could be constructed as simply a rate reduction, and that would turn that plan into a net positive for the state. And it may be that we get a more scaled down kind of base broadening, which is kind of what we've been anticipating over time as part of a response to lower rates. If it's a more general, more modest expansion, then we would see a net positive if that's the main element to the plan.
No, I just think we're not going to know anything until June 15th.
We're not going to know anything?
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see what we can do. Even at the soonest.
Right, Mr. Chair. I mean, we need to have, if something happens prior to June 15th or on June 15th, we know that we need to take action before we walk out this door regardless. I mean, just... And like every other contingency we plan in this committee for the last 4 years, it's just another one to go in the pile for contingencies, because the dynamics are all over the place. I mean, last time we saw a 20% increase, which we didn't necessarily anticipate. Right now, based on the information we have, LROs, you know, flip a coin, net equal, maybe a slight loss. Tax Foundation says it's a 10 to 15% increase. Their economists say that in Oregon. The Pew says that, you know, man is falling from heaven, somewhere between 16 and 46%. So it's just all over the place. We're not going to know, and, you know, despite what everybody says, in my mind, given we have been involved in these revenue discussions or revenue actions, those of us have been here a few years, that between the 15th and the 10th. Is that right? Sine die is the 10th. It's amazing what you can do in those 25 days. So.
Well, in the meantime, though, I still think it argues for us in our little slice of the universe to keep charging forward with the challenges we have in front of us and react to the federal government when it's time. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
Excellent, thanks.
Okay. We'll close down until Monday at 8:30. Okay. Thank you. We are adjourned.